Welcome. Thank you for being here and offering me your attention for some time. And thank you, Doug and Cliff, for spontaneously offering me this slot to give a talk. It can be a little bit inconvenient to come up with something, but on the other hand, it's a nice opportunity to clarify one's own thoughts about things, to hear oneself talking about something, sometimes when one gathers one's mind around the topic. So I'm glad to jump into this opportunity. And to be sincere, it was just this morning that I was thinking what I was going to talk about, and I came to the garden and looking at the garden, I thought I would like to talk about mind gardening or cultivating the mind. And look at our practice. And when I say our practice, I'm talking about it in a broader way. Like, what are we using this life for? That's what I'm talking about. And I see that the garden brought many metaphors when I was looking at it, and I would like to share some of these metaphors and ideas and see if they make sense to you too. And actually, it's easy to think about practice about us cultivating a garden. And actually, one of the words that has been translated in the West as meditation is the word bhavana, Sanskrit word that goes for cultivation. To practice bhavana is to cultivate something. And we can have different kinds of bhavana. We can have metta or maitri bhavana, the cultivation of love. We can have karuna bhavana, or the cultivation of compassion. Or shamatha bhavana, the cultivation of mental quiescence or tranquility of mind, and so on. And another word that has been translated in the West as meditation is the Tibetan gom, which literally means becoming familiar with. So when we're practicing meditation, or when we're doing our practice, what we're doing is familiarizing, getting familiar with. With what? It's a good question. Getting familiar with ourselves, with the functioning of our minds and hearts. Getting familiar how we work and how we can cultivate the states of mind and heart that are conducive to happiness for oneself and for others. So I like this idea of cultivation. In a way, it's an organic metaphor. It implies time. The gardener does cannot hurry the organic processes. The gardener cannot just grab a plant by its trunk or branches and say, "Grow then, you have to grow now, at my will." We cannot force or push. The only thing that we can do as gardeners of our mind is to facilitate the conditions and, in a way, get out of the way of life doing its own work. The good gardener knows how the elements work, knows what the soil does, knows how much water it's needed. And then it leaves nature do its thing. It also implies that we're not creating something out of nothing. When we practice, we're not starting from a blank space from which we want to create something, idea out of that. The gardener starts with the elements, starts with seeds that are already there with all its mystery and magic, and starts with some soil, and starts with some, hopefully some compost, and some other things that will help the plants grow. So when we're practicing, we also start not from a blank slate, but we start with what we have. And the place where we are is the right place to start, always. Because there's no other place from where to start. If we start from an idealized place, not really seeing where we are, we're not going to go very far. We need to recognize what's our situation in this moment, and then apply what is needed. And the kind of plants that we cultivate, of course, depends on the types of seed that we have. We cannot grow tomatoes out of lettuce seeds, or grow oak trees from orange seeds. We're going to get the trees from the seeds that we help grow. And we have all kinds of seeds. In Buddhist psychology, it is said that we have a reservoir of seeds. Bijas is the word for seeds in Sanskrit. And this kind of unconscious substrate of the mind is called the alaya, vijnana, where all these seeds, positive and negative seeds, virtuous, non-virtuous, happy, unhappy, skillful and skillful seeds, just by being a part of this human race, we all have the seeds for enlightenment, and we all have the seeds for tremendous ignorance and hatred and fear. Last weekend we were singing Call Me By My True Names, by a poem by Thich Nhat Hanh, where he talks about this, like, I am the frog in living in the pond, but I'm also the snake that goes and feeds on this frog. We have the seeds to become many different things. So it's not so much what seeds do we have, but which seeds do we nourish. So, and also for the gardener, is the gardener can have the seeds of plants that he wants to grow, she wants to grow, but also the seeds of wheat will be there. So it depends on what you pull out constantly with patient effort, and what seeds you water. So the good news is that we have the seeds of perfect understanding and boundless compassion within us. It's a birthright that we have just because we're humans. We have the lack of being born in this realm. So the potential for compassion of an open heart and full understanding, omniscience, is within us. But it's in a state of seed when we're born. And it's partially our responsibility to care for those seeds. And for me, practice is that. And of course, the plants will grow regardless where they're tending them or when we're away from them. The gardener knows that too. If he leaves the garden, it's not that nothing is going to happen. Things will keep working on their own ways out of habit, patterns, and what is available. So with our minds too, I think if we have the illusion that our practice is what happens inside the sendo, we can have trouble. Because even if we, let's say we have a strong practice and we practice 4 hours a day, 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the evening, sitting still and quiet and nice, we still have another 12 or 13 hours of our waking life. And during the sleep, we dream, and in dreaming we also reinforce the habit patterns of the mind. So there's still a lot of room for different kind of seeds to be cultivated. So as I said, perfect understanding and perfect compassion, or mature compassion and mature understanding, are there in seeds. And you can see this almost since we're born. When we're born, our kids are very young, are avid to learn. And that's the seed of understanding. We want to understand everything. We want to communicate. We want to learn about the world. The seed is there. And conventional education gives us the tool to refine that seed of understanding to a certain level, which is the ability to manipulate concepts and discern, having some discernment. But from the Buddhist perspective, that's not the end of the path, but just kind of midway through it. And also the seeds of love, it's clearly there. It's embedded in our nature. If it wasn't there, we wouldn't survive. If mothers were not compassionate, who would be alive in this room? It's impossible for years to take care of babies crying at night, waiting for long hours to go pick them after a party when they're in their teenage years, and all that parents do. It's embedded. It's in our bodies and in our brains. We are wired up for love. But also, it's limited the way it's wired, because we have love and compassion for those who are our close friends and family members, and those who look like us, those who are similar to us, it's easier to have compassion for. So in a way, the Buddha Dharma is a path to developing those seeds beyond the conventional level of loving those who are nice and likable, and understanding beyond dual conceptions of what we perceive. So I see the Dharma like a plant support. I don't know how you call that. Like a stick that you put next to a young tree. We call that guía in Spanish, a guide, something that guides the plant to help it grow. So when the plant is tender, is young, it needs a guide, it needs some fence, some protection. In southern Chile, we have the rabbits that come and eat the roots of the tree and kill them. So when they're very young, here you have deer and whatnot, probably diverse threats to the plants. So we could see that fence, that protection, as the precepts, sila, some basic guidelines in how to live life in a way that this tree is not overthrown by strong winds of afflictive emotions, particularly greed, anger, and many others. So Dharma supports this young plant and scaffolds this plant for the seeds of wisdom and compassion to grow and flourish as big trees. And then I was reflecting in which are the tools of the mind gardener. And I thought that the paramitas could be a good tool set for the gardener. Traditionally, the paramitas are thought also with another metaphor as the raft or the boat that take us from the shore of delusion, of samsara, to the shore of liberation, nirvana, realizing our true nature. But in the context of our garden, this can be seen as the fork, the shovel, and everything that we use to take care of this ecology of mind. So these tools are Dana Paramita. That's the first one, giving from the heart, giving without reservations, open-heartedly, without expecting anything in return. And I like to think about this one as giving the simplest things is the most important, like giving a smile, giving presence, caring presence, giving tolerance, giving spaciousness. I think sometimes those things are more difficult than offering money or gifts or anything that help us pop up ourselves with pride of giving important things. Then we have Sila Paramita that I mentioned, which can be understood as some behavioral restrictions, but I like them. I like to see them more as an ethics of considerateness. It's just seeing how my mental actions, my words, and my behaviors affect others at the obvious level, but also at the subtle level, because the energy of our actions also influence what is possible, what happens in an environment. The third one, Shanti Paramita. I practice yoga, and usually at the end of the yoga practice, we sing Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Because patience is so important as one of the tools for the gardener. Traditionally, shanti or patience is defined as forbearing anger. But sometimes that is misunderstood as suppressing anger, which is one extreme, and being the other extreme, expressing anger. So the path here is not to express, not to repress, but to hold anger in the energy of mindfulness and see what's behind it, what's fueling it. Usually behind anger, there is fear. There is an ego that is fragile. And that is not to condemn that ego, because condemnation is going to bring up more anger. But recognize things are fragile. And anger, as it was discussed, I think, a week ago in the Dharma talk, it's a fuel. It can be a fuel for things, for getting things done sometimes, or setting limits. But anger is an inefficient fuel that burns hot and costly. It makes us sick. It deteriorates our immune system. The cortisol levels goes up. Inflammation of the body goes up because it's getting into the mood of fight or flight. When we are in that mood, the body activates. We prepare for that physically. Although many of the threats that we face these days are not really physical. There are no lions running after us. It's just we get triggered by how our image is perceived by others and what are our power struggles and other stuff. Usually, why I'm emphasizing this and why the teachers emphasize so much this is because, not because anger is a sinful thing, but anger solidifies the self so much that is why the teachings go over and over to talk about anger. When I have anger towards someone or towards a situation, I'm totally different and apart and solid from that. So I think Ian mentioned Shantideva an Indian master from the 8th century, and he pronounced a beautiful long text called The Way to the Bodhisattva's, The Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And there is a full chapter there on patience. So I think that's a big tool for the gardener, patience. Not just with anger, not just to forbear anger, but to forbear any emotion, afflictive emotion that comes like waves. And so the practice is learning to surf the wave without necessarily to act impulsively on that. And then when those emotions get worked out, they turn into something very valuable for the gardener. They turn into compost for nourishing the plants. So it's not that we want to keep those emotions away. We want to bring them in, transform them. And that brings all the juice and nutrients for a true garden to grow. If you keep anger aside or desire aside out of the path, you don't have any compost to nourish the plants. But it's common that we don't want to see those aspects. Then the fourth paramita is virya, paramita, right effort, which was explained by the Buddha using this garden metaphor as not letting the unskillful seeds that have not sprouted sprout, just keep them there, not nourish them. Then when the negative seeds have sprouted, don't feed them, just let them slowly starve. Then the positive seeds that have sprouted, water them, tend them so that they can grow. And the positive seeds that have not sprouted yet, help them sprout and grow. Those are the four practices of virya, of the right effort. And also right effort implies being in the middle way between not doing anything about something and becoming obsessive about something to happen, where the ego comes and has an agenda. Then jhana paramita, the fifth paramita, is what we most practice in a Zen center. It's where most of the energy is put, is refining attention through meditation exercises. Through refining attention, the perception gets refined, so we can move beyond, as the Heart Sutra said, going beyond, to go beyond the gross perceptions or the gross level of the mind to a subtler and subtler levels of the mind, to perceive reality as it is. And the sixth paramita is prajna, which is that, is understanding things as they are. So the last thing I want to say about this gardener that we all are is that there are some nutrients that our plants, this plant of wisdom and compassion, can get so that it grows. And again, according to the Buddha, there are four kinds of nutrients that are available for the gardener. The first one is material food. What we eat is the material basis. And we can notice that if we eat heavy, fatty food, the mind will feel dull and heavy and unclear. If we eat spicy food and we are in meditation, so we are more refined in our attention, we will feel fire in the body. So that's the coarsest nutrient that we can use But then there is perception, is the second nutrient. Everything that we perceive is food for the mind, is a nutrient of the garden of the mind. So everything we read, everything we pay attention to basically feeds different seeds in the mind. Different kind of conversations, what are different kinds of seeds? And the third nutrient is intention. Lately in the last year, I've been trying to ask myself that question. What is what I really want in this life? Remembering that life is short and the end is uncertain. It can be later today, you never know. I ask myself in my heart of hearts, and if anything were possible, what do I really want to accomplish in this life? And if anything were possible, what I want to offer to the world? I think going to there to clarify which are our intentions when we do what we do, particularly when we sit, but not only when we sit, when we go around doing things. In Buddhism, it is said that the karma is not related to an action, it's related to the intention that is attached to that action. A man with a knife cuts somebody else's belly. It's neutral. It can be a doctor doing surgery and saving someone's life. But it can also be how do you call it? A robber?
A murderer.
So the nature of the action is defined by the intention. And the last nutrient for the plant is consciousness. Basically, whatever is in our consciousness, whatever mental formation, perception, sensation, and form, everything is feeding this garden 24 hours a day, every day of our lives. Then, moment by moment. So one of the beauties is in helping this tree grow is that when it reaches a certain height, it doesn't need too much support or fences. It, trees get to a point where they have a strength that they can care for themselves and kind of the energy flows into them. So if one feeds this young plant enough, it will start taking care more and more, taking more care of itself without so much energy. And the circumstances in life will become more and more conducive for the plant to grow. It's just how things work. And the other beautiful thing is that when this happens, without pride, it supports countless other beings. The plant, when it's mature enough, when it grows to a certain size, start offering endless resources to local and non-local beings. It starts hosting a myriad of insects, little animals. It offers flowers, beauty, shade, exchanges oxygen with carbon dioxide. And it doesn't seem to be doing much. It's just there manifesting its true nature, which is being a tree. But it's hosting life and is offering things that will be useful in the other corner of the world. So there is an element of faith too in the gardener, in the work of the gardener. He cannot control, she cannot control what's going to happen. He or she knows by experience that when certain things come together, it's very likely that we're going to have a nice garden. But really, she or he doesn't know for sure. So there's an element of trusting, of faith. Trusting that circumstances will provide what is needed, but also trust in myself that I will be resourceful enough to face what the path brings. Sorry about the long talk. So I don't know if there's time for a few comments or questions. Greg.
Thank you. It's a really informative talk. The garden is a very rich metaphor. I never saw it that deeply. But I want to go back to what you mentioned in the beginning, which I thought was very important. And my question is probably has no answer.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like there's a lot of questions like that. But this point you made about we have to start from where we are, mm-hmm. where we really are,
mm-hmm.
not from where we imagine we are, or where yeah. we would like to be, or where we think we might be, but from really from where we are. And when I was a young man, once upon a time, in beginning meditation practice, I really didn't know where I was. Or I mean, I imagined I was in a place that I wasn't mature enough to be in. And unfortunately, I came across a meditation teacher who supported my denial and told everybody, oh, therapists are all confused anyway, and therapy is a waste of time, and all you need is meditation, and so on and so forth. So that fit into my own confusion quite well, and delayed me from finding out where I was. So I was, basically my question is there any way that you know of that people can use to find out where they are, mm-hmm. where they really are?
Mm-hmm. Thank you for your comment. It's very valuable, especially coming from you and all your experience. Actually, I had a similar experience. And it's, as I've spent some time in different monasteries and practice centers of different traditions, I see that there is a pattern that is a little bit repetitive. That in a practice center, strong idealizations of self or teacher sometimes delude both teacher and practitioners in where they are and what they need. I think it's valuable that you mention psychological aspects, because from my perspective, Dharma practice is for is aimed to address existential suffering, like that we all share as human beings, and not for addressing psychological problems on top of the existential suffering. I think that there is a common agreement now that meditation is not a pill that will solve all the problems, and shouldn't be used that way, but should be complemented with good therapy to address issues that are not existential but relational, psychological, personality related issues. So there is writing, a lot of writing on spiritual bypassing, which is what you just mentioned, which is avoiding psychological issues by adopting a spiritual form that supposedly transcends the psychological, but it really doesn't. And that, I think that's why we have a lot of messed up stories with teachers becoming abusive. Usually the big ones is sex, anger, and power. And usually they're related. And that is exploding everywhere. So it's a big one. And I think one simple way to check if where we are with practice is to ask those who live with us, how are we treating them? That's something that I'm doing with my study on compassion cultivation. Besides the questionnaires that people will answer before and after, I'm going to interview the family members and to see if they see any changes. Is the person more understanding? Is the person kinder? Is the person a little bit more patient? Because I think relationship is where the rubber meets the road. Is that how you say? In the human realm, is relationship, really.
That's very good. I don't want to be intrusive, but I was wondering if you could speak about yourself, your life. How did you get here, you know? Where you've been and how you got here?
I can give a short answer.
Maybe another talk too sometime. Be good on that. I'm curious, because the long answer would be also interesting.
Thank you. I'm a psychologist, clinical psychologist from Chile, and I came here 3 years ago to do a PhD in transpersonal psychology, and I'm researching compassion cultivation.
Is it in Menlo Park, that place, or where?
Yes, the place I used to be in Menlo Park, the Institute of Transpersonal Psychology.
There,
it's in Palo Alto, and with the Stanford Center for Compassion and Altruism, a center that started like 4 years ago with the Office of the Dalai Lama and psychologists at Stanford. And I've been a Dharma practitioner since 1999. I practiced Zen Buddhism for like 4 or 5 years. Unfortunately, I had a problem with a teacher. I ended up burning my rakusu.
Was this in Chile?
Yes, in Chile. So being here is the first time that I'm in a Zen context after some years. But I've spent time in Theravada monasteries and in Tibetan Buddhist temples for a while, but mostly independent, studying and going to specific teachers to get specific teachings. But I'm a little bit homeless in the Dharma.
A little what?
Homeless or explorer. It's a more positive connotation. So that's a little bit.
Are you living here now?
I'm a guest here at Jikoji for the following 3 months before I return to Chile to do my research.
Oh.
Yeah. So I'm back and forth from the States and Chile.
You have a family? This is an intake interview. I'm a psychologist.
Yes. I have a partner. She's living in Chile. She was with me for 6 months lately, and we're going to see each other again when I'm in Chile. And I have my brothers, my parents, that I just saw like 3 weeks ago, and I haven't seen them for 3 years, so it was a nice reencounter with them. For me, it was a time for checking also how was practice going, like to share with family and see. Because we had a lot of tension with in my father especially, but it's going, I think practice is going well. Thank you.